So, I'm going to speak to you here for maybe 40 minutes or so about, the Juno Beach Center. But we're going to start with a bit of a history catch-up. And I'm sure you all are well aware of D-Day and the Battle of Normandy, but it's always good to have a refresher. And maybe you'll learn something new along the way. As was stated in my introduction, I work for the Juno Beach Center Association, which is the Canadian-based charity that owns and operates the museum over in Normandy. And so it's my job to kind of do, among other things, to do events like this, bring the museum in certain ways to Canadians here in Canada, especially during COVID, where we've not had very many Canadian visitors, unfortunately, as you can understand. So I'll just outline my presentation here quickly. So we'll start with Canada's participation on D-Day and the Battle of Normandy, a little bit of the history, as I said. We'll then move to explore the reasons and circumstances behind the creation of the Juno Beach Center back in the 90s and early 2000s. We'll introduce you to the Juno Beach Center and the ways in which we go about honoring our veterans. And I want to give you a little bit of a teaser into the future, our plans for how the Juno Beach Center is going to develop over the next few years and how Canadians can support the museum overseas. To the history. So we're going to start with the situation in Europe in spring 1944. Of course, Canada entered the Second World War on September 10th, 1939, and our participation in the war was a massive effort overseas and on the home front. Around 1.5 million Canadian men and women aided and served in both Europe and at home during the course of the war. And as you can see on this map, in the spring of 1944, Germany had occupied France and much of the European continent for almost 4 years. You can see on this map towards the bottom, you've got Italy starting to be, first conquered, I suppose. And then when they, changed sides, liberated in 1943, in the early part of 1944. But for the rest of it, you've got a massive battle on the Eastern Front, of course, against the Soviets. And then you have, Western Europe is very much in the Nazi hands. So D-Day and the Battle of Normandy. It's always, everybody, they like to attribute certain things to D-Day and various operations. For instance, it's sometimes said that D-Day was the largest amphibious operation in military history. Some people also say it's the largest invasion in military history. Those things are true depending on what figures you're looking for. But what I can say with absolute certainty is it was the largest combined operation in military history. And by that, we mean aircraft, ships, and troops. So almost 12,000 aircraft operating, almost 7,000 ships and landing craft, 6,900 ships and landing craft in this operation. They were delivering 133,000 seaborne troops with 156,000 troops overall, and that includes the airborne, of which there were about 500 or so, between 500 and 600 Canadians. And over 14,000 of those landing on Juno Beach were Canadian. And so D-Day, of course, was the Allied assault by British, Canadian, and Americans on the Normandy beaches on June 6th to take back the European continent from Nazi Germany, the idea being you land, you gain a foothold to build up, you fight a large battle with the German armed forces, you beat them, and then you can advance into Germany. That's the general concept. And so in the early hours of June 6, 1944, Canadians began coming ashore at Juno Beach in the face of deadly enemy fire. Their mission was to establish a beachhead along this about 8-kilometer stretch of beach fronting the villages of Courseulles-sur-Mer in the west, Bernières-sur-Mer in the center, and Saint-Aubin-sur-Mer in the east. The Canadians were very much attacking into kind of one of the heavier defended sectors of the D-Day landing beach areas. And this was partially done because there were, those three villages. It was a bit of an urban combat situation very early on after the landings. And the Germans had kind of evacuated parts of those towns and turned them into, death traps, if you will, to defend the beaches. Most Canadian soldiers in the campaign were young and new to battle. There were a few veterans, brought in from the Italian campaign and elsewhere. you know, but, you know, the 2nd Division, which had fought at Dieppe, was not here on D-Day, for instance. Some of the Canadians were, you know, just out of high school. Many had lied about their age to enlist. But yet their courage and skill led the Allied advance against a determined enemy. And all of the Canadians involved on D-Day itself were volunteers. They had volunteered at some point during the war for overseas service. Although some of them actually may have been conscripted earlier in the war, they had volunteered to go overseas and to fight. By the end of the day, 381 Canadians had been killed, both, you know, on land, at sea, and in the air. And the Canadian infantry divisions in Normandy, there were two infantry divisions, Canadian infantry divisions, would suffer the most casualties of any division in the British Army Group, in General Montgomery's 21st Army Group, during the battle. It's also often said that the Canadians on D-Day advanced further inland than any of the other Allied forces. It depends, again, what you're measuring and what units you're measuring. There are other units that actually advanced perhaps just as far, maybe further. The Canadians certainly went the furthest south, but other units were advancing in different directions. And honestly, it wasn't really a race to see who could get the furthest. It was, you know, and we'll get into that in a second. So we know with the benefit of hindsight that D-Day succeeded, but this was no guarantee. And so I've got this note. This was written by General Dwight Eisenhower, the Allied Supreme Commander, you know, American general. And he wrote, quote, "Our landings in the Cherbourg-Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." So Eisenhower actually wrote this. He dated it July 5th, but he obviously got that wrong. He actually wrote it on June 5th. And he actually ended up tossing this message in a waste paper basket, and one of his aides actually saved it. But it just goes to show a couple of things about Eisenhower and about the operation itself. Even though this was a massive operation supported in every conceivable way, there was still a reasonable chance, maybe not a high chance, that it could fail. And Eisenhower, by writing this letter, this was going to be his statement if things went awry, indicates that he, even though he knew all of the planning and everything that was going on, he knew that there was a chance it could fail, and he was willing to, essentially, to fall on his sword if that took place. It's also very interesting in here. There's a point where he actually scribbles some stuff out, and what I read to you is the final version. But he actually originally wrote, "The troops have been withdrawn," but he scratched that out, and that was, you know, he used passive voice in that sense, and he changed it to, "I have withdrawn the troops, so I made the decision to do that." And so again, he's willing to take ownership of the decisions, you know, for ill or for good. A bit about where D-Day was. So, you know, we're looking at kind of northwestern France and Normandy down here. And we're looking at the south of England up here and the English Channel in between. The land forces used on D-Day sailed from bases along the south coast of England, the most important of these being Portsmouth here, which is also, you'll note, where 3rd Canadian Infantry Division is located. That's where their kind of preparatory camps and everything are for them to, at first finalize any training, but secondly to prepare for the operation and to be isolated and out of the public so that they, you know, no word of the operation gets out once they're briefed and everything like that. You can also note this glob over here in Kent, and that's 2nd Canadian Corps. So 2nd Canadian Corps was a higher level formation of the Canadian Army, and it would follow on in July of 1944. But it's out in Kent, and one of the interesting activities that it's doing is it's actually part of the fictitious 1st United States Army Group, which was supposedly under General Patton. A lot is made, especially in the movie Patton, of Patton's role in Operation Fortitude and trying to convince the Germans that the Allies are going to land over here at the Pas-de-Calais. and that the landing down here in Normandy is actually a feint to get the Germans to deploy their resources instead of looking at the main effort. So most of Patton's 1st U.S. Army group was actually completely fictitious. It was just, you know, men on paper, essentially, and equipment on paper. But the Canadians were part of that effort, and they were actually some of the formations like the 2nd Canadian Infantry Division and the 1st or the 4th Canadian Armored Division were actually stationed in Kent, and they would actually do road movements and do and send radio traffic to try to convince the Germans that they were actually part of this, you know, larger army that was, you know, mostly fictitious, to keep the Germans' eyes focused here as opposed to down here in the main area. Just a quick map here of the various landing areas. So you have the 82nd and 101st Airborne coming in on the west, again protecting the flank of the American landing beaches, and also trying to capture towns like Carentan to connect Utah Beach with Omaha Beach, as you'll see in a second. You've got the British 6th Airborne Division, of which there were about 500 or so Canadian paratroopers, with the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion landing on the eastern flank. Their job to basically blow bridges, actually attack a battery of German guns in this area, and to basically secure the flank against any German movements to try to, you know, roll up the beaches from the east. You've got the American beaches at Utah and Omaha. As I said, there's a bit of a separation between the two, so that's why these airborne troops are important, to kind of help connect them. You've got the British at Golden Sword beaches, flanking the Canadians at Juneau Beach. This map has Courcelles-sur-Mer marked on there, but of course there's a series of towns along that beachhead there. Here's what it looks like, kind of blown up and zoomed in a little bit. You've got the 3rd Canadian Infantry Division is landing with two assault brigades, the 7th and the 8th Brigade. So you've got Canadians from, it's kind of interesting how this works, actually. You've got Canadians from the Canadian Scottish Regiment, which is out in Vancouver, over here in the west. You've got the Royal Winnipeg Rifles, supported by a squadron of the 1st Hussars tanks from London, Ontario. You've got the Regina Rifles landing at Courcelles on the main town. The Juneau Beach Center is on this location. Then you've got the Bernier-sur-Mer assault. You've got the Queen's Own Rifles from Toronto with B Squadron, the 4th Fort Garry Horse from Winnipeg and from Manitoba. Then you've got the North Shore New Brunswick Regiment with C Squadron of the Fort Garry Horse over here, basically landing between Bernier-sur-Mer and Saint-Aubin-sur-Mer as well. You also have some British commandos landing on the flank to help, again, secure and be kind of a filler between the Canadians at Juneau and the British at Sword Beach here. You can see there's a few lines on this map in terms of the initial advances on D-Day. There's a dotted line here. This is the Elm Line. This is the intermediate objective that the Canadians were hopeful to get to on D-Day, and you can see they largely got there on D-Day, with the front line ending here on the 6th and 7th of June. And then I have the second part of the map. You have the Oak Line. This was the final D-Day objective that the Canadians were supposed to get to. Now, the reason they didn't get there isn't because they didn't, you know, fight hard or anything like that. They certainly took a heck of a lot of casualties on the beach and some tough fighting. The issue was actually, you can kind of see it here, there's a bit of a gap between Sword Beach over here and the forces securing that and the Canadians at Juneau. And there was a German counterattack that actually came in late on the afternoon of D-Day. There was a division of panzer tanks, the 21st Panzer Division base just south of Caen, and they advanced this way. And so that, coupled with a few other things that were going on across the front, meant that the not the Canadian commander, but a British higher level commander, basically ordered everybody to dig in on their immediate objectives. And so that's what the Canadians did. The intent the next day was to continue to drive south and to get to that Oak Line. As you can see, the forces of 7th Brigade managed to do that. The forces of the 9th Brigade, which was a reserve brigade that came ashore in the afternoon of D-Day, they didn't manage to get to the Oak Line, but what they did is they had basically there was a big encounter battle over here. And by that, we have, you know, basically a group of Canadian infantry and tanks moving down a road towards the Oak Line. They are ambushed initially by elements of the 21st Panzer Division and the 12th SS Panzer Division. And they basically fight each other to a standstill. The Canadians actually ended up having to withdraw, you know, retreat kind of to this line here where they could find some defensible ground. But it was really neither side, you know, really gained a huge advantage. And at the end of the day, the job of the Canadians on Juneau Beach in particular, and really new research, it's about the last 10 years, research suggests we need to change the way we kind of think about this stuff, because the Canadians landed with more firepower. The Canadian division landed with more artillery than pretty much any other single division on D-Day. And the reason they did so was because the Allied planners knew that this terrain out here was really good terrain for enemy tanks. And they realized that the only way the Germans would ever have a hope of defeating the Allies on D-Day and in Normandy was for them to bring a large counterattacking tank force to bear and try to throw the Allies back into the sea. And what the Germans are trying to do in the first few days after the landings is just this. They actually gather elements of three panzer divisions on the Canadian front to try to do this. And at the end of the day, though there are some minor reverses for the Canadians, they do stop the panzer counterattack cold. And that's a part of the story that's not often talked about. You know, we tend to talk about D-Day and we kind of stop on the 6th. But really, D-Day is just the start of a very long campaign. And this was a crucial moment in the campaign between kind of June 7th and June 9th, where the Germans tried to throw the Allies back into the sea in the Canadian sector, and they failed to do so. By the way, I wanted to mention that map that I was showing you there is actually available in our online gift shop if you're interested in getting a copy for yourself. I have some color photos here of Juneau Beach on D-Day. So this image is Bernier-sur-Mer on June 6, 1944. You can see some of the barrage balloons are already up. It's an original color image. This is not colorized. It's originally taken in color. You can see this is a landing craft tank, the larger vessel, and it's carrying a number of Sherman tanks into the beach. You can see the steeple of Bernier-sur-Mer behind the image here. This smaller craft is a landing craft assault. That's kind of what the infantry would use to get ashore, holding between, you know, about 30 men or so. You've got another shot of Bernier-sur-Mer a bit later in the day when the tide has gone out, the Canadian reserves coming ashore. On D-Day, you can see kind of equipment on the beaches. You've got a universal carrier here. You can see some of the fascines they've already kind of put down to help with traction and grip on the beach. And you can see here's another landing craft tank and some other landing crafts approaching the beach as well in the background. This is Corsol-sur-Mer, which is the town near where the museum exists. The museum itself actually exists in this spot right here in the center of the image. You can see that the buildings are on fire, or at least there's smoke coming off the buildings. Damaged buildings on the seafront here where the Regina rifles had attacked. You can see on the right here, you've got a number of troops and landing craft coming ashore, and they're all all moving to the right, which is to the west, to find an exit over here, because this is a bit of a squeeze in here, a bit of a peninsula. There's the harbor of the town here, and then there's the River Souls here, and some of the bunkers that are right outside the museum can still be visited in this sector right here. The dunes have protected, as I said earlier. So just to summarize Canada on D-Day, I'm sure I have my correct slide here. So it was a very large effort by Canada. About Juneau Beach, there were about 21,000 troops that landed on Juneau Beach. About two-thirds of those were Canadian. There were 7,000 British troops, you know, among them being some of the British commandos, for instance. The British also had Royal Marine armored support vehicles. specialist armored support vehicles with you know, to clear minefields and to do other things as well, lay some of those tracks and fascines to help the vehicles get across the beach. The Royal Canadian Air Force actually committed 39 of its own squadrons to the operation on D-Day. There are 39 squadrons, RCAF squadrons, with the D-Day battle honor. The Canadian Air Force squadrons lost 7 aircraft, and 22 Canadian airmen were killed. And by 22 airmen killed, I'm not just talking about the Canadian squadrons, but rather Canadians serving across the British Commonwealth in Royal Air Force squadrons as well. The Royal Canadian Navy, it had 61 major warships, anything from kind of the size of like a minesweeper to a destroyer, a bunch of corvettes as well. There on D-Day, 61 major warships is actually a larger number than the Americans had. Now, the Americans had larger warships. They had battleships and cruisers and everything. But the Canadian Navy actually had more major warships, anything, again, from the size of a minesweeper to a destroyer, than the U.S. Navy did on D-Day. We also crewed 46 landing craft. The Canadians had 17 motor torpedo boats. In terms of casualties, all we can find in the records is it looks like there were several that were wounded, especially those who were manning the landing craft and bringing the troops ashore. I was quite surprised we couldn't find anyone who had been killed, being that those, you know, jobs were quite dangerous, depending on the conditions you were landing under. As I said, 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion jumped with about 543 paratroopers. On D-Day, 19 of these men were killed, 10 were wounded, and 84 were captured, so fairly heavy casualties on D-Day. On Juno Beach, you know, casualties were 340 soldiers killed. These are Canadians, 574 wounded and 47 captured. And the total cost to Canada for the day, that is air, land, and sea, is 381 killed. You'll often see 359 killed. In fact, I think that number is still on our website. And that is the, if you add the numbers from Juno Beach and you add the numbers from the parachute battalion, but it doesn't include the numbers of the airmen killed in the air fighting above and around the D-Day beaches. And so our total is 381. Now, I've thrown some numbers at you there, but I wanted to also give you more of a personal understanding of the cost here. So I have this lovely Heritage Minute that Historica Canada produced in 2019, along with support from some of our team members, actually, to help tell this story. So I'll let this play. Let me know if for some reason you can't hear it or anything.
They were just kids from New Brunswick. Never even left the North Shore before. Dad trained them the best he could. But how could they possibly be prepared? This was the biggest operation the world had ever seen. He'd already served in the First World War, earned the right to stay home, raise his children. But how could he send those boys into battle and not be by their side? Many were killed that day. One was my father.
Major Archie McNaughton was 47 when he died on D-Day, the invasion that marked the beginning of the end of the Second World War.
So that's a quick story, just to show the human side. And also to indicate, you know, like I said before, many of the Canadians who were there on D-Day were very young. But some of them were not as young, and Major McNaughton was actually a First World War veteran. And just so if you're interested in learning more about his story, I have a great resource for you, and I'm quickly going to show this. This is our website, junobeach.org. You can go to our From Vimy to Juno online exhibition, and we have his story here. So if you wanted to learn more about John Archibald McNaughton, his story, number of letters that he wrote, both in the First World War and in the Second World War, to loved ones back in Canada, especially his wife, Grace. I definitely encourage you to check that out. Bring my PowerPoint back up here. There we are. move on. So some reflections from Canadians who were there and who survived D-Day and the Battle of Normandy. So Hugh Buckley is the first soldier. He was an armored soldier with the Sherbrooke Fusiliers. I believe he was a loader operator on a Stuart light tank. And he said the arrowhead was Canadian. I think the reason was because every Canadian soldier there was a volunteer. The next man is Garth Webb. He was a lieutenant in the 14th Field Artillery Regiment who landed on D-Day. And he said, it was like the Grey Cup and the Stanley Cup and the World Series all played on the same day. And I'm not only there, but I'm playing. The third gentleman is Lockie Fulton. He was a major and company commander in the Royal Winnipeg Rifles, I believe. He said, June 6, 1944 is a day that will remain forever in the memories of those who survived. So to jump ahead a bit, I'm going to summarize the Battle of Normandy for you. So the campaign lasted about 76 days, including D-Day itself, into mid to late August of 1944. They actually thought it would take about 90 days to defeat the Germans in France, and they actually beat that target. Two German armies were destroyed, or at least heavily decimated. The combat power of nearly 40 divisions. German casualties, you know, difficult to come by, you know, in terms of absolute figures, but certainly, you know, anywhere between 300 and 450,000 killed, wounded, and missing are, you know, terrible numbers. Allied casualties, you know, just over 200,000 ground soldiers and nearly 30,000 airmen. You know, can't forget the air component in particular, plenty of casualties there. So this is a very bloody battle. It's, you know, on a day-by-day basis, it ranks up there with things like Passchendaele, with battles like Passchendaele from the First World War, in terms of the number of casualties. Canadian casualties in the Battle of Normandy, again, over 76 days. This is army casualties. About 18,700. Again, this is killed, wounded, and missing. And nearly 5,500 Canadians are buried in Normandy. So about, you know, 5,500 Canadians killed during the Battle of Normandy. That includes airmen. And that's a pretty incredible figure. Not to take anything away from the Italian campaign, but the Italian campaign, I think, lasted something like over 18 months for Canada. And our casualties there were about, you know, 5,000 killed. So in just 3 months, we're losing almost as many, you know, maybe it's closer to 6,000 for Italy, I should say. So in just about, you know, 3 months, we're losing almost as many casualties in terms of killed in Normandy as we did during the entire time that the Canadian Army was in Italy. So that's just to give you an idea of the bloodiness of this fighting. The good news is that after the German defeat in Normandy, the Battle of France is very quickly won because the Germans need determined that they're basically routed. They need to withdraw almost all the way back to the German border. And so for the next, you know, from kind of late August to late September, early October, the Canadians are basically just like the rest of the Allied armies in pursuit mode. And the Canadians have a very particular task. This is the direction of 1st Canadian Army, which was comprised of the 2nd Canadian Corps and the 1st British Corps. And it illustrates their efforts to move from Normandy to go across the coast in particular and to liberate various channel ports along the way. Among them, the 2nd Canadian Infantry Division actually liberates Dieppe in early September 1944. And that's a story I can tell you a little bit about during my second talk. But this was a time of kind of great euphoria as the Allies were, you know, moving quickly through, you know, no longer Nazi-occupied France, but there were still pretty significant heavy fighting left to go, especially up here in Belgium and in the Western Netherlands in the Battle of the Scheldt, which happens in October and November of 1944. Now, one of the things that happened is, you know, the Canadians up here, but the British who are, you know, to the right of the Canadians over here is, we're very quickly overrunning the same terrain that was fought over, you know, for years during the First World War. I mean, if you see here on Lens on this map here in Arras, Vimy is just quite near Lens here. You've got Amiens, you've got the River Somme is right here. And so you're very quickly going through these areas. And one Canadian war correspondent, Matthew Halton, was part of, you know, he was following the advance, and he had this to say in a broadcast that he recorded for Remembrance Day in 1944.
But as I stood at Vimy Ridge before going on through the darkling plain toward Belgium, my thoughts went back to Normandy, to that road from Caen to Falaise. And if there were ghosts round Vimy Ridge as we swept past that day, I wonder if they were saying something like this. Listen, what are you going to do after this war? Perhaps you're going to build a memorial twice as high as this one on the road from Caen to Falaise to commemorate our sons, the dead and damned battalions, the Black Watch and the North Nova Scotias and the rest. Arras, Bapaume, Ypres, and Vimy Ridge, that was the anthem of the doomed youth of one generation. Bretteville, Caen, Tilly, and Falaise, that's the anthem for the doomed youth of another. We died, our sons died, what are you going to do?
And so that was, you know, Matthew Halton's message in 1944. You know, Canadians were already starting to think about how this war would be commemorated in the future. And this is where I want to transition from the history to kind of the memory of the Second World War in Canada, and to give you kind of an understanding as to why the Juno Beach Centre came to exist. So the Juno Beach Centre exists due to the way that Canadians remembered or perhaps failed to remember the Second World War through to the 1990s. And there's a few reasons for this. So for instance, there was first a focus on functional commemoration and tacking on to the First World War. So functional commemoration being, you know, let's, you know, we get home, we're going to build a better Canadian society. You know, we're going to build an arena, we're going to build a library or something, and we're going to name it a memorial arena or a memorial library after, you know, the Canadians and their sacrifices during the Second World War. And instead of, you know, creating new memorials for the Second World War, what we typically did in Canada was we just tacked on to the First World War memorials. So all the cenotaphs, you know, across the country, we added a list of casualties to those memorials instead of creating a separate memorial for the Second World War. There was a big debate going on between, you know, do you do the classic memorials, you know, cenotaphs and that sort of thing, or do you do a functional memorial? And that was, you know, the debate was never truly solved, but each, you know, community made their own decisions. As well, the Second World War was not such a contested event. I think we can all understand, and we all understood at the time, that the Nazis were bad. They needed to be defeated. The Holocaust and genocide that was uncovered, you know, later in the war spoke to that. And I think there was also an element among the veterans that that was a job that we had to do, and now it's time to get back to work, to go and make my career, to work on building a better country, etc. And so perhaps the better country is the monument to the war. I don't know. It's an open question. There's also questions around, should we be building memorials or should we be spending money on veterans? The veteran benefits that the Canadians got in the, there were some exceptions, especially among certain groups that were, you know, for instance, some of the prisoners of war did not get, immediately did not get the benefits that they needed. Indigenous Canadians were sometimes turned away in terms of getting the benefits that they were entitled to. But it did come down to this question, should we be building memorials or spending money on veterans? And this country largely said, we are going to spend money on veterans. We are going to invest in that generation. You know, we're going to make sure that they can buy houses. We're going to make sure that they can get jobs. We're going to make sure that they can get education so that they can enter the workforce. And perhaps it wasn't until, you know, the mid-1990s for the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and that was in 1994, and the 50th anniversary for victory in Europe and the liberation of Holland in 1995, that Canadians really started to wake up to what our veterans did for the world. And that was, you know, people were watching the ceremonies for D-Day and perhaps even more importantly for the liberation of the Netherlands and how the Dutch welcomed, Canadian veterans back to thank them. And that started to wake some people up. There's some other things that were happening too. The Americans are in their film, industry, they're producing things at the end of the 90s, like Saving Private Ryan, The Thin Red Line, Band of Brothers eventually comes on in the early 2000s, 2001. And so these all have impacts here in Canada as well. In the mid-1990s, Garth Webb, our founder, Normandy veteran, he visited Normandy and was shocked by the fact that there wasn't really much there. There was a few, individual regiments had their own memorials and that sort of thing, but there was really nothing there to commemorate the overall Canadian story. And so he kind of set out to build the memorial that Matthew Halton spoke about, where's this large memorial, like this Vimy Ridge type memorial? And what he wanted though was an education center. And he set out to help to start to build the Juneau Beach Center.
But as I
stood on there, so Lieutenant Garth Webb was born in Midland, Ontario, raised in Calgary. And as I said, he landed on D-Day with the 14th Field Regiment. Alongside his partner, Lise Cooper, who is a widow of a Second World War veteran, they worked to be the driving force behind the creation of the Juneau Beach Center. They wanted to build a center that could proudly pass the torch of remembrance to younger generations. And so that's what they set out to do. And that's why we ended up with, the Juneau Beach Center, a museum and education center. There is a small, monument outside the museum, but it's not, it's not the same thing as the Vimy Memorial, for instance. I think they raised something like $10 million in support of that effort. And the museum opened in 2003, 1 year in advance of the 60th anniversary of D-Day. So kind of 1 year to prepare for that event. So again, Juneau Beach Center is located on the very site where Canadians landed on June 6, 1944. There's a couple of veterans, one veteran in particular from the Royal Winnipeg Rifles who basically landed a stone's throw from the museum. But the museum goes far beyond telling the story of Canadians on D-Day. It pays homage to the nearly 45,000 Canadians who died during the Second World War in all theaters and also honors those who, worked to pursue the war at home. It also serves as kind of a mini embassy for Canada in France, allowing visitors from all over the world, in particular Europe, to learn about Canadian values and culture. Some of our guiding principles. So it's a piece of Canada in Normandy, open and accessible to all. As I've stated, it's a place of education, especially for youth. We want it to continue to be a museum and center that Canadians are proud of, and that helps Europeans better understand Canada's contributions during the Second World War. It's a place for Canadians to gather, to remember, and give thanks. And it's really become a place over the last couple of decades almost now where Canadians and other, we have a lot of British veterans, for instance, who come and visit the museum because they landed on Juneau Beach. A place for them to come to remember along with, the future generations, especially the youth as well. And so these are some of the earlier images from some of the earlier ceremonies at the museum here. And of course, the number of veterans that we still have is in rapid decline at this point. Just a few statistics about the Juneau Beach Center. We've had over 1 million visitors since June of 2003. More than 10,000 student tour groups since the same time. We actually, for the first time, had over 100,000 visitors in 1 year in 2019. And usually in a non-COVID year, about one quarter of our visitors are Canadian. Though the COVID-19 pandemic is having obviously a significant impact, both in terms of closures and in terms of, the limits on the number of people who can come into the museum at any one time. Mostly it's the closures and just the lack of, travel that people are doing these days. 33,000 visitors in 2020, And 2021, the last 2 years, we've only had 33,000 visitors. And so that's had an impact on our revenues, both for the museum itself, ticket sales, and for the gift shop, for instance. And so we have been struggling a little bit, although the Veterans Affairs Canada has very graciously helped us out in the last couple of years to kind of alleviate some of that stress. Very short video showcasing what the Juneau Beach Centre has to offer here. And so that video gave you, you know, a basic idea of what's available at the museum for visitors, but I think it gave you some nice images of the bunkers that are outside the museum. And that these opened to the public in 2014. Volunteers dug out about 20 tons of sand to unveil and make accessible these German defenses in time for the 70th anniversary. And we were hoping, you know, it depends on funding and everything, but we plan to conduct further research into the German use of these positions and how Canadian troops overcame them as funds allow. These are, you know, quite impressive and quite well-preserved defensive positions. You know, it was also very critical for our founders at the museum, for our founding veterans, for Canadians and for, you know, anybody visiting the museum to be greeted by a Canadian. And so they wanted to establish the guide program, which is still running in spite of COVID. We do have guides, not right now over there, but the next cohort will be on their way, hopefully by the end of this month. And so more than 150 young Canadians have gained work experience in France through this program. And we hire in a non-COVID year about 8 to 10 guides every year. It's been about 6 or so during the COVID period. But it's always very important to our veterans for people to, you know, get a Canadian greeting when they visited the museum, you know, from people who were close to the age of many of those soldiers who lost their lives during the Second World War. We have the Canadian, the museum staff are a mix of Canadians and locals from France. And so what's great about the guides in particular is they allow us, they help us to have this year-round programming that features kind of Canadian cultural elements. So, you know, things like Halloween, Canada Day, you know, Remembrance Day, Christmas and celebrating Christmas as well, and some of the Canadian traditions involved there are on display at the museum as well. So it's a really great mesh of, you know, Canadian and French cultures by a team that is from both countries. We had our big moment, you know, more recently at the in June of 2019 at the 75th anniversary of D-Day. I think there were something like 40 veterans in attendance. Which will probably be the last time we have that many veterans in attendance on site at one time. You know, hopefully we'll get some veterans in 2024 for the 80th anniversary, but I'm sure it perhaps will not be that many And it was really a great time for Canadians to come together and to remember, 75 years on, and to, say goodbye to those veterans, who many of whom are no longer with us even today. And we've lost a number of veterans who were there with us in 2019 since then. So after more than 18 years now, we continue to operate, thanks to the entrance fees at the museum, the guided tours and boutique sales. Again, COVID's having an impact on that. We have our commemorative brick program and other special campaigns, and the very generous support of the Government of Canada through Veterans Affairs Canada for, the guide program, our educational programming, and various museum upgrades. The future of the museum, a sneak peek at our future plans here. We're working on a major sustainable development and expansion strategy for 2024. The museum itself, once COVID is over and we have our numbers starting to return to pre-COVID, the museum needs to expand to meet that demand and to do so in a sustainable way that reduces our overall carbon footprint. And so we need to invest in existing and new infrastructure to do that. And over in France, our staff had actually secured about $3.65 million in funding from French regional and European governments to support the initiative. And so we're in just the startup phase of a capital campaign to raise the additional $1.7 million to fully fund the initiative. At the core of this initiative, or at the heart of it, I should say, is our Room G, Faces of Canada Today. And so one of this museum's strengths is bringing Canada to the world in a way, on site. And this is a real highly sought after feature of the museum by a lot of the local schools and education groups, is learning about Canada. And so we've always had a Canada in the World Today room, or a Faces of Canada Today room. But the exhibition dates from 2003, and so it's quite outdated. It's in dire need of a transformation to reflect Canada's modern veterans and 21st century Canada. As a general example, because it was built in 2003, there is nothing about the war in Afghanistan in that exhibition, for instance, in our Afghan veterans. We're planning a grand reopening for the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and we're hoping that this will become the crown jewel of our Sustainable Development Expansion Initiative. In that particular room, we've already raised 100,000 of what we still need to fund it, and we need about just shy of $300,000 more to finalize the arrangements for that room. And so we're very excited about that. How do we go about commemorating veterans? Well, obviously, other than welcoming the veterans, one of the things we do is we have our commemorative brick program, and we've used this for many years as a means to raise funds for the museum. These are kind of the bricks that helped build the Juno Beach Center. And so more than 12,000 titanium bricks have been sponsored. And we now have fewer than 250 spaces remaining in the program. Generally speaking, some schools, do soldier research into these bricks, or, family members, who, especially those who have visited the museum, say, I would really like, for my grandfather or my uncle or, my aunt or whoever, to be commemorated, on these bricks. And we're very flexible. If you wanted to do a modern veteran, we're happy to accommodate that as well. It's not just for Second World War veterans necessarily. We also have our flag sponsorship program. And this is a relatively new program brought about by COVID-19. Basically, the brick program, the way it typically works is someone goes and visits the museum, sees the brick kiosk, and they say, oh, that's a great idea. Well, fewer Canadians are able to go, and so we were trying to find ways we could bring bits of the Juno Beach Centre to Canada, and then this is one of the ways we can do that. And so what we do is we fly flags, every day at the museum, Canadian flags, and they have to be replaced every so often. And so we now created a program whereby you can sponsor a Canadian flag that's been flown at the Juno Beach Centre, and we'll send that flag to your residents in Canada for a donation. We've also got our online store, and I have a little bit of an offer for you here, actually. We have our Juno Beach Center themed clothing. There's the D-Day map I was referring to earlier and using to illustrate the earlier part of this talk. We have a whole bunch of other items in that shop. And so if you go to junobeach.org and click onto our online shop, you'll find it there. And we have a bit of a discount code for you here today. So if you spend $50, you can get 5% off your purchase with code Juno550. So feel free to please check that out if you can. We hope you'll consider traveling to Juno Beach once victory over COVID is achieved. Not sure when that will be, but we're really hopeful that we'll get more Canadians later in 2022 and beyond, of course. And if you ever have any questions, need information, recommendations about visiting the Juno Beach Center or visiting Normandy, please don't hesitate to reach out to us, because we're happy to help to ensure that you have a memorable and evocative experience at both the Juno Beach Center and, at the Vimy Memorial, for instance. I mean, I think they're approximately 3 or 4 hours apart. So you can, you can certainly visit both in the course of a visit to France. And as I said, I wanted to tease, the last thing I'll do before we move to questions, I wanted to tease our From Dieppe to Juno exhibit and the talk that I'll be giving to you in a couple of months. And I'll do that with this video here. And with that, I'll turn things over to you folks for questions. I just leave you with this quote from Bill Anderson, who was one of the veterans who visited us in 2019 and unfortunately has since passed away. He said, "I feel welcomed here. I feel as if you're visiting me." And that's the legacy our veterans leave for us. And that's, the torch that we carry for them moving forward into the future, as they're no longer with us. So thank you so very much for your time, for your attention today, and happy to take any and all questions.